are the Liberators Movement for Justice. We are a group of community activists, people who have come from the Coalition Against Police Execution. There are people here from different various organizations here that are working with us. And we're open to work with anyone who is, at this point, trying to focus on how to win justice for Oscar Grant. What we and why we came together is because it was not a real focus on strategy, especially legal. I feel that in the movement, one of the things that is missing is knowledge about legal strategy in terms of these next steps that will be happening, specifically what will happen tomorrow, what's to be expected in this preliminary hearing, what is the purpose of the preliminary hearing, what could happen. These are all things that we will deal with today. We'll also deal with the bigger picture in terms of the political implications of this issue, this battle, inside the courts and outside, and then come up with a plan, a battle plan for how we can better organize and how we can actually reach people in the community at large so that people have the means and the tools to be able to organize themselves. So in a nutshell, we're going to get started and go right into an introduction of our attorneys. I'm going to pass this off to Rachel, and she'll be able to give you a better introduction in terms of who these attorneys are.
Hey, how you doing out there? Like we're in this big place. My name is Rachel Jackson, and I am with the New Year's Movement for Justice. Thanks again for coming out, especially on this very hot day. We did this event because, you know, for a lot of us, we've been involved in a number of cases like this, Rodney King and Gerald Hall, the first killing by a BART police officer and so on. But what we tend to do is we're constantly going out with an abstract call for justice. You know, if we just call hard enough and long enough and get enough people and so on, then we will get justice somehow. And in this particular case, because like you said, because this case is so historic and because, you know, in as much proportion that it is a tragedy, it's also an opportunity. And so we brought our panel here today to talk about some of the particularities and give you all an opportunity to ask questions and find out really more about the process. You know, normally we wouldn't get so caught up in a legal process and, you know, the courts and relying on the courts, and we're never going to rely on the courts for justice, obviously, you know, totally for all the change that we need, but there's some specific things we need to understand, and that's why we brought this, that's why we pulled this together today. So our first person to speak on panel is Kim Malcheski, who's a criminal defense attorney from San Francisco, a long time experience, whatever, active and conscious, what's that? That's a who's worked with us for a long time, for many years, and has a lot of experience, same with Bob Evans, and Daryl Stallworth, and we have the privilege of having someone who've actually, have two people actually, who have worked as prosecutors in the past. Which is, you know, really a huge opportunity for us to actually hear how these cases get handled and seen from the other side. Like when you're really, you know, when you really are trying to put the person away, it's not something that we really get to hear very often. And finally, our final person on the panel is Andre Heron. And has also similarly, you know, been on both sides, but both. Daryl and Andre also now work against the death penalty and with death penalty focus. So, I'm going to turn it over to you all to start with Kim, and we're going to try to get through presentations around the procedural stuff as quickly as possible so that we can move right into question and answer and really get into some of the, you know, some of the deeper, harder kind of political questions that we have around this case and how we can organize around this case.
Yeah, you want to try that one? It's also fine. Again, I want to thank everybody for coming out this afternoon. I'm just going to talk briefly about the procedural stages the case will go through until it gets to trial. I think it'd be best if General and others talk about the preliminary hearing itself. So what's going to happen this week is the preliminary hearing. We'll talk about that in more detail. And then let's say we get what we want in the preliminary hearing. What do we want? We want this cop to be held over to trial on the charge of murder. And so what happens after that? Let's say we get what we want at this preliminary hearing. What happens? The case will then probably go through kind of the motions phase. And what that means is lawyers bring motions. What is a motion? A motion is something you file in writing and argue to the judge, or you ask the judge to do something. And assuming the cop, our killer cop here, is held to trial on charge of murder, the defense will ask that the case be dismissed. They'll file what is called a 995 motion to dismiss. It's just a written motion, and they will argue it in front of the judge a month or two after the preliminary hearing. And they'll ask, basically the defense attorney is going to say that it's an accidental killing, or the alternative that it should be reduced to manslaughter. I think Daryl's going to talk about the difference between murder and manslaughter in more detail. But the most important pretrial motion will most likely be a motion for a change of venue. And we anticipate that the defense attorneys will probably do that because they do not want the trial to occur in Alameda County. And as we all show, I'm sure you all remember the Rodney King case, what happened there. They sent the case to Simi Valley, which is in Ventura County. It was a very conservative and almost all-white jury, and Rodney King was acquitted in the first state court trial. So what happens is, if there's a motion for change of venue, again, the lawyers file a bunch of written documents in front of the judge. There will be a public court hearing, and we'll argue it in front of the judge. And, of course, we have to go to all the substantive court dates. And in a nutshell, the legal test for a change of venue is whether the pretrial publicity has been so extensive on the media that the defendant cannot get a fair trial. And this is, unfortunately for us, a case where there is a good chance the defendant will probably get a change of venue. So what happens then? So there's something called the Administrative Office of the Courts in San Francisco. It's a very unknown state agency. They talk about it, they talk to judges around the state, and they come up with three or four recommendations to the judges in Oakland. And after further arguments and discussions with the attorneys, the presiding judge in Oakland probably make the decision where the case is sent to trial. And again, that's only if the judge makes the decision that it's necessary to send it somewhere else for a fair trial. The problem is the whole venue process is very, very slippery, is what we found out in the Rodney King case. There are very few clear-cut guidelines on which county should be sent to. So I would suggest that our demand should be that if there is a change of venue, it should be sent to L.A. County, which has a similar diversity to Alameda County. I don't know if people remember the horrible dog mauling case in San Francisco, where there's really sleazy lawyers that have this killer dog in their building. Well, that case was sent from San Francisco to L.A. County. And I think we should take that as a political precedent, and that the case should be sent to L.A. County if there is a change of venue. And I think that's the most important pretrial motion that we have to deal with. And that's a very important political demand. We do not want the case to be sent to some predominantly white county in the valley. We don't want the Beverly Hillbillies to be on the jury. We want the grandma and grandpa. And that's what happens. I do cases around the state, and outside of a few counties, you get predominantly white juries. And mainly, usually because district attorneys exclude all African Americans and people of color from juries. In this case, it's going to be the flip side. These cop attorneys are very, very aggressive, and I can tell you right now, they're going to try to boot every African-American and every young person of color off the jury. And that's what's going to happen. So that's the most important legal motion that I would suggest that we organize around legally and politically to ensure that we get a fair trial. We, the people, and the Oscar Grant family get a fair trial. And we have a right to a fair trial in this matter, just like the defendant does. So that's about all I have to say right now. Rachel? I don't know if you guys want to talk about the preliminary hearing.
All right. The process is coming up tomorrow for this preliminary hearing. Before they get into the preliminary hearing, based on what we've seen from the press, there will be a motion by the defense attorneys to disqualify the district attorney's office, the Alameda County District Attorney. If it were granted, it would mean that things would get delayed and the prosecution would get transferred to the Attorney General's office. The basis on which they're filing this motion is that when the Oakland cops went to take Messerly into custody after he was arrested and to bring him back to Oakland, they tried to ask him questions. He invoked his right to remain silent, and they immediately stopped, which is what they're supposed to do. But their complaint is that they shouldn't have even tried to ask him questions in the first place because they knew he had a lawyer. And if it's true that they knew he had a lawyer, which they deny, and which technically didn't have a lawyer until he was around, but if it's true they knew he had a lawyer, technically they probably shouldn't have tried to talk to him at all. But I don't think their motion to disqualify the district attorney is going to get anywhere, primarily because they didn't get anything about trying to talk to him. He immediately said, "I won't talk to you, I want my lawyer," and they went away. So they didn't actually question him, they just asked him if he wanted to answer questions. So that's the first thing that's going to happen, and I would be very surprised if the defense got its way. It would cause a substantial delay while the Attorney General came into the case. But assuming that's denied, what's the preliminary hearing? Preliminary hearing is a hearing where they introduce evidence to show that there is quote-unquote reasonable cause or probable cause to believe that a crime was committed and that this person committed it. The burden of proof at a preliminary hearing is very low. The defendants almost always get held to answer, on the charges that are in the complaint. Held to answer means the judge at the preliminary hearing says, yeah, there's enough evidence to make this person stand trial. They will present evidence with live witnesses. They will present evidence that he and getting raped. Present evidence by having cops testify to what particular witnesses they've spoken to have told them. This is one of the changes that was made some years ago in Prop 115 in the preliminary hearing process to make it more friendly to the prosecution. Whether or not that's done is questionable. It's a tactical decision by the district attorney. Often it's not done, especially in this county, because the district attorney wants to get an idea of how his witnesses are going to stand up to cross-examination, because that tells him how he's going to handle the case in the plea bargaining stage after the case is held against him. Another reason not to do it is that if a witness testifies at the preliminary hearing and is not available at the trial, which maybe a year or two down the line, his preliminary hearing testimony can be read into evidence, whereas if all they have is the cop testifying to what he said, that can't be read into evidence at a trial. So there are reasons for the district attorney to bring the live witnesses in. There's reasons for the district attorney not to bring live witnesses in, because it protects them from being subjected to cross-examination by a defense attorney. But it's a tactical decision to be made by the district attorney based upon what we assume is his desire to proceed as vigorously as possible. Whether that's really his desire, who knows? This is an unusual case when a cop is being prosecuted for something he did as a cop. So one can never be sure exactly what the district attorney's office is going to do, but if we assume that they're going to prosecute the case vigorously, we can also assume that there's going to be a holding order on a murder charge. In theory, there could be a holding order on a manslaughter charge or an involuntary manslaughter charge. Darrell will talk a little bit about what the differences are between murder and manslaughter, the two types of manslaughter. But that's not likely, because in order to reduce this homicide from a murder to a manslaughter, it would be almost essential for the defense to put the defendant on the witness stand, and that's something that's not going to happen. So what we can expect is that Messerly will be held against her on a charge of murder. How long the preliminary hearing will last depends on how the district attorney presents his case, and it depends on whether the defense is allowed to present evidence. We know they have subpoenaed people who were witnesses to the event. One of the changes that was made in the preliminary hearing process by Proposition 115 was before the defense can present evidence at a preliminary hearing, they have to make an offer of proof as to what the witnesses are going to say. And they very well might not be able to do that if the district attorney is being vigorous in his pursuit of quote-unquote the people's rights. The witnesses would not be allowed to testify unless that offer of proof can be made. The judge before whom the preliminary hearing is set, Don Clay, has a background that is primarily a pro-defense background, which means that he's going to be in kind of the same awkward situation that some of us are in, that we're looking to use the pro-prosecution devices that we normally oppose, because that's what we want to see happen in this case. What software suits, what software loses the software again? If they can do it against us, we do it against them. But Don Clay was an assistant U.S. attorney for a while, and before that he was a defense attorney, criminal defense attorney. He's sharp, he knows what he's doing, and he knows what the low burden of proof in the preliminary hearing is. So one can expect that he's not going to be cowed by the Fox lawyer. So that is, in a nutshell, what we can expect to happen tomorrow. The preliminary hearing might last a couple of days, depending on how the evidence is put on. But at the end, I think we will expect to see a holding order on a murder charge.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Rachel. I'm going to provide just a little bit of perspective and background on what you can expect to see this week, and maybe in the big picture what you can get yourself ready for with regard to understanding the journey of going through a murder trial. Bob was correct about a preliminary hearing. It's a hearing that has a very low standard of proof. The judge only has to be able to determine whether or not there's enough information provided that a jury can make a decision. And that decision could be first-degree murder, second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, or acquittal. All the judge needs to know is that a jury could, based on this evidence, make that decision. And realistically, the prosecutor could simply just play the tape, and the judge can have a holding order, because there's no ID issue here. There's no question that Oscar Grant was killed. And aside from some type of self-defense theory which would make the killing lawful, I don't see where this particular event is not at the minimum an unlawful killing, which means it's going to go to trial. What a prosecutor could do in preparation for preliminary hearing is bring in witnesses that were there at the station. Maybe give some background information about when the officers were on duty, how long they were there, how many different angles they might have been able to see the intro event, witnesses' input on what Mesley might have said before the shooting, some things he might have said afterwards, which are admissible because he wasn't in custody or being interrogated. Some of these might be helpful, but really, a preliminary hearing can take all of about 5 minutes and they just pay the tape. With that being said, what happens after preliminary hearing? Because unless something miraculous happens, this is going to be a holding order for murder. And murder comes into play in four ways. First degree, second degree, voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter. The complaint doesn't identify which level. He says murder. And the prosecutor gets to argue all four of those levels depending on what the evidence is. And as Bob mentioned before, what the evidence presents in this case to a jury really is going to be boiled down to what's going on in the shooter's mind. Murder is one of those types of crimes that, unlike other crimes like robbery or burglary, where you can see what happens and pretty much determine that someone went into a bank, took money, walked out, that's a robbery. A murder case requires a mental state. A mental state is a very complicated situation. No one knows what's in the shooter's mind unless the shooter tells you. The exception being, and what happens oftentimes when a shooter does not testify or give a statement is, what can you take from all of the circumstantial evidence and make a conclusion of what was in the shooter's mind? Last example is, if I walk into a store and shot somebody 15 times in the head, 15 shots to the head normally means that this is some type of premeditation, which means this is probably a first-degree murder. One shot to the head makes that less obvious. With no information and no other witnesses, it makes it even more complicated. You're driving a vehicle and you come to a stop sign, and all of a sudden the car merges forward and it kills two people. Is that murder or manslaughter? Did your foot slip off the brake and go to the gas? Or did you intentionally push the gas and go through the intersection? If you don't have a statement from that person, what a jury would have to try to find out and determine is this person a bad driver? Is this person on alcohol or drugs? What are other people saying about what this person said who may have been in the car? You think about that analogy and you think about this particular type of case, I suspect that at a trial, what you're going to be able to get from the prosecutor, since Mesley did not give a statement, is all of the circumstantial evidence that can be deduced to show what the likely mental state would have been. And if the jury concludes that the mental state was a premeditated, intentional, deliberate murder, and that's first degree. The jury concludes that it was an impulsive act that was intentional and not premeditated, in the second degree. The jury believes that in the heat of passion or a sudden quarrel, more likely in this case, that Mesley had an honest but unreasonable belief in self-defense, then it's voluntary manslaughter. If the jury believes, and this most likely is going to have to come through his testimony, that it was an accidental shooting, I didn't know I was pulling the trigger. I thought I had a taser. Something's malfunctioned with the gun. We don't know any history about the gun. All those things may make it possible for involuntary manslaughter. And you all know that there's different penalties that attach to all four levels of that particular crime. So what I'm hoping to be able to at least plant the seed with today is that understand that the mental state of a homicide case is the most important feature that you need to know. And most often in this case, you may not know that until the defendant takes the stand. Thank you.
So actually, I have the easiest position on this panel today because my job is basically to open the floor to questions that you might have based on some of the things you've heard here today or other questions that you may have generally about the case. I would say if there are three things you should take away from this activity today, they are that, number one, it's not going to be like a Law and Order episode and take 1 hour. Number two, what seems to us to be a moral outcome and what will ultimately be a legal outcome may not be the same thing. And I think we have a tendency as lay people to confuse morality and the law, and they don't necessarily go together. So what we think is the right outcome may not be the outcome we actually get. And the last thing, of course, which is what I think we already know and which is why we're here today, is that this whole thing is political. It's all political. So part of what I hope you'll be working on today is figuring out how you can have the most impact that you can have on this process. Obviously, our ability to impact the legal process is going to be somewhat limited because what happens legally is pretty much determined by what goes on in that courtroom. And though all of us have an idea about what we think should happen or what we expect to happen, what actually happens may be something entirely different. So part of our commitment as a community is to commit to being willing to see this thing through. Because there are going to be delays. This trial is not going to happen immediately like we are used to seeing on as soon as they find the body, then in a couple of hours or a couple of days they got the trial. There are going to be a lot of pretrial motions. There are going to be all these issues that the lawyers have just spoken to you about the defense trying to change the locus or location of the trial because of publicity. There will be a lot of things that will happen between now and when we ultimately get whatever the final outcome is going to be. So we have to be prepared for the possibility that it's not only going to take a long time, but it may not be the outcome we want. And so there's a longer term objective here, and that is, one, speaking out and trying to protect the interests of Oscar Grant as a community, doing what we can as a community to impact this entire process so that we don't have another Oscar Grant case happening down the road, and making sure that justice is done for his family and his offspring so that whoever is responsible ultimately for his death should be required to make sure that his family is made as whole as it can be, even though they're never going to be able to bring him back. So with those points, I would just open the floor up to questions, and I think this esteemed panel can probably answer whatever concerns you might have. Right here in the front.
Yeah, so I got two things. One being, I know that I've been to a murder trial, you know, with cops involved, and I know that there's motions. So there's motions in limine, and I know those are early on, like what they don't want brought to the courtroom, even though that's going to make a big impact. So I'm wondering if you have any idea what they're going to go for getting eliminated, and given this judge, maybe they're not going to be successful in keeping valid evidence out. And the other thing I want to say is my sister and I are from San Jose, and we went to the court trial, the grand jury, and the court trial against Michael Walker, who murdered Ruby Cardenas a few years ago. And then, 2003. And it took a while for it to get to trial, but the DA, Lane Liddell, did an excellent job of proving beyond a reasonable doubt from all the footage that was shown, security cameras, eyewitness testimony, and they still came and acquitted, you know, the jury found Michael Walker not guilty, which was not even one person. It wasn't, you know, it had to be unanimous. So it was really shocking. So as we're telling you exactly, we may not get what we want. So one of the things that I think we need to make sure that we do is talk about the wonderful person that Oscar Grant was, because they're going to be famed in the courtroom. And we got to find out if this evidence is showing what kind of person Mezard was, so that his character gets, you know, full out there too, not that he always needs this wonderful, brave person. So we need to keep doing that no matter where this goes. We want to continue to speak out very vocally wherever this ends up, so people know who Oscar Grant was and what happened.
Speak briefly to the question about motions and limine that happened before trial and even before preliminary hearing. There's laws of evidence that allow attorneys to introduce statements, records, documents, but they have to be properly laid and have to be foundations. And then there's also one kind of catch-all law. It's called Penal Code Section 352, which is this information more prejudicial than probative? And that oftentimes can determine whether or not something that may be legally admissible will eventually make it to court. But I would give you some assurance that with the judge that's in the preliminary hearing, which is a very intelligent judge, and all the judges on would be a county bench if it were to stay here. Other Senate trials, there's some judges over there that have tried over 1,000 cases. So they know what gets to come in and what doesn't come in. And normally, with very few exceptions, those type of things don't have the type of impact on a case that most people might think. I think Hollywood sometimes over-dramatizes or embellishes, you know, that piece of evidence that didn't get in, and therefore this person would not have been convicted. That normally, most often, doesn't happen. There's a real good opportunity for both the prosecutor and the defense to produce evidence that's admissible, with very few exceptions. And that being said, also when you're talking about the character of the victim and the character of the defendant, in this type of case, it will be relevant. But to what extent? How much information does the jury get to know about Oscar Grant, meaning prior type of activities he might have involved in? And you won't know a lot about Mr. Medley unless he takes a stand, because it won't become an issue unless he takes a stand and gets a statement. So a lot of those things are going to be what I think takes most of the time on the front end of the trial, which is finding out which ones are admissible and which ones are more prejudicial and probative, or more probative than prejudicial. But once all that is done, I believe you can really rest assured that the jury will get enough information to make a decision.
Okay, thank you again for that response, and we definitely encourage all questions. Try and keep your questions as concise and as short as possible, but we definitely encourage that.
How you doing? You said something about the honest mental state before you committed the murder?
At the time? And that affects it too, but go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so if mentally assaulted another young man that was on the same platform, his friend, and he assaulted him and then handcuffed him and then went over to Oscar Grant and murdered him, does that show his state of mind? That he was in a violent state of mind?
Those are the type of things that a jury could consider when coming to the ultimate decision. But it isn't conclusive. It's just another part of the whole picture. All those things are the circumstantial evidence that could lead a jury to make that conclusion. And that's something they can consider, yes.
I have a really big concern about if the trial does get moved to a different county, then what judge is going to get picked to hear the case. My even bigger concern of mine is the attorney who's going to represent Oscar Grant. And is that attorney, is he really, truly going to defend Oscar Grant, or is he going to look like, pretend like he's really defending Oscar Grant? Because if you go back, back in the day of trials where it looked like the attorney was actually defending a person, he really wasn't. And it's just this whole system that's called legal injustice isn't. And it's really hard during the trial to see that the attorney isn't really doing what he's supposed to be doing. So I don't know how to find out if the attorney really, I understand now the DA is doing it. From what I understand, the DA hasn't been doing his job up to now to really defend Oscar. So is there any way to get a really good attorney to defend Oscar?
Well, I think your question really touches upon something that is often confusing to people, and that is when the state is prosecuting a crime, it is not representing the particular individual who was harmed or killed, but the people's interest. So the concerns you have about the person representing Oscar Grant may be two separate things. I mean, obviously the DA has a duty to present the case in a manner that properly prosecutes the cop for the unlawful actions he committed. Defending or protecting Oscar Grant's individual rights, however, is not necessarily part of the criminal case. That may be part of the civil case, and when you hear the stories about John Burns representing his family, that is a proceeding that's completely separate from what is going on in terms of the criminal case. So it's important to keep those clear.
I use the wrong words, but it's making sure that the attorney who is going to be prosecuting
Well, I think the most important thing you can do is be there. You know, I was telling Rachel when we were talking about this that one of the things I observed changed before my very eyes when I was in DA was the way the courts dealt with people who were drunk drivers. Before the organization MAD got started, they used to just, whenever somebody came in with a DUI, they slap them on the wrist, give them a short fine, maybe they had to spend a couple of weekend days, nights in jail, and that was it. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving organized themselves so that every time there was a drunk driving case, they were there in force. They didn't disrupt the proceedings, they were just there present, they were there watching what the judges did, and over, you know, not an immediate, it wasn't an immediate change, but over time, judges get uncomfortable when they know the public is watching what they do. Most times, most of us are not aware of or involved in legal proceedings we hear about through the media or whatever. But the presence of the community at those proceedings can have a great impact on how the judge rules on different things. And the hard part, of course, is having a sustained presence. Because we got to work, we got to feed our families. We can't be in court 9 to 5 every day. And part of what the organizing around this issue may mean is figuring out whether there are those of us in the community who can attend that hearing on certain days and coordinating that so that we have a daily presence at those proceedings. That's the best effort you're going to be able to make to hold the DA to the fire and make sure he's not letting the cops slide because he's got a curry favor with them on another proceeding down the road or something like that. So that would be my advice, presence.
Hi, I have two quick questions. If there is an ongoing lawsuit or a successful lawsuit against the department in terms of Johannes Messer having attacked or beaten other people of color, is that admissible in terms of showing a pattern of behavior? And I also wanted to know, if we don't get the legal result that we want, is our focus then going to turn to how an appeal, perhaps based on the DA not doing their job? Because the opening documents I've seen from the case show that the DA hasn't really been maybe as aggressive as they need to be.
Okay, I'll probably answer some of that. And it may not be a popular answer for some of you, but having been a former DA in Alameda County, it has come to my attention on a number of cases that that's been a critique of the DA's office. But I know from being involved in thousands of murder cases over the years that average time that it takes to get to a preliminary hearing is about a year to 16 months. In this case, it's already, you know, half that time is already at a preliminary hearing. They've got a prosecutor and two investigators. The state has three independent investigative teams working on the shooting, the killing. Never in the history of my 18 years have I ever seen this much attention, this much work on a case. And we have 150 murders in Oakland every year. And none of those cases have ever gotten the type of attention, the type of resources, and the type of focus. So we've got to be real careful about talking about nobody's doing anything. Because there's more being done in this particular case than the hundreds of cases combined over the last number of years. So what you might ideally like to see, oftentimes is not possible. There's not the type of resources. This is not a county that only has one or two murders a year. There's just not the resources to give more time than you can imagine on a particular case. But I know from this case, and I know from everything that I know about it, that it's been given an awful lot of resources, an awful lot of time, a lot of investigation. Tom Morloff doesn't review murder cases. That's not his job. He spent 2 weeks reviewing this one. So that within itself is already beyond the call of duty with regard to what he's doing. So let's just try to keep that in perspective. And when those type of reviews are made, I think we can have more credibility as a community. We really understand the big picture of what's going on. Otherwise, it's not going to have a lot of integrity if we just say the DA is not doing anything, because in fact, that's not really the case when we talk about resources and time.
I think you can say that the DA wasn't doing anything, but for instance, there's a mention of possible grants in the administrative state, was very negative description, and this is from the DA, who is supposed to be talking to the U.S. Muslim. And so I'm wondering if that kind of thing could be used to kind of feel that it's possible.
One of the things I want to say, just to try to answer your questions more specifically about prior incidents with Messerly, though that would be the kind of thing that his lawyers will try to keep out. But it is fair fodder for trying to show what his state of mind was at the time. With respect to whether there are some other avenues if we don't get the result we want in the criminal trial, part of that is being addressed by the civil action that's being brought on behalf of his family. And there is some possibility that if enough attention were brought to bear on this case, it might be the kind of case that the U.S. attorney might get involved in. There may be a possibility of pursuing some benefit on behalf of Oscar Grant's family because of the violation of his civil rights under federal law. So there may be other avenues, and I'm sure those are being pursued and considered by the lawyers who are working on the civil side of this case. But yes, it's very complicated, and I think, again, vigilance and presence is going to be the most decisive factor, because, believe me, the DA understands how much of a tinderbox this case is. It's intensely political. Everything they do is going to be scrutinized, and they know that people are angry and they are frustrated. So I think they're going to be moving with those considerations in mind at all times. And the more we can let them know that we aren't going to forget about Oscar Grant, and we aren't going to let them off the hook about it, then I think we'll see them moving in directions, if not in this case, to get the result we want, that maybe things will be put in place, citizen review boards, other things, so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
One other comment, you mentioned appeal. The prosecution does not have the right to appeal in a criminal case. And as far as prior incidents involving Messerly and other people, that would come into evidence only if the Messerly defense team screwed up and put his character into evidence. Generally speaking, in a criminal case, evidence of prior bad acts by the defendant are not admissible, but the defendant might, by his testimony and by his defense, make them admissible by putting his character into evidence.
I have a question. It's fairly common knowledge that in this country, police who kill are never convicted of murder. Most walk, and some those who don't walk are convicted of lesser charges. And this is a standard thing throughout the entire history. And this is what we're up against in this case. The question is really, how is that always the case? How does that always happen? And in particular, how does the police department, or all the police departments working together, because of a certain community they have on this stuff, actually obstruct the process to prevent anybody from coming to the point of conviction for murder? How do they actually do that? How do they band together? How do they obstruct the process? And what are the things that we should look for in that, to understand, to expose, to put pressure on, to try to break down the process of having that has been always there? is this going up against an ever-present pattern that's never been broken and trying to break it into this space.
You just asked the ultimate existential question about power and all that. I think some of it is due to just the way society is set up so that when a cop does something and it's happening presumably in performance of his or her lawful duties, that muddies the water considerably. I think part of the problem is there's a certain immunity that attaches to governmental actions. It's not pleasant or necessarily desirable, but it's often the starting point for how we determine whether a person who's an officer is criminally responsible. So I think that complicates the entire equation a lot more than if it were just regular citizens shooting each other. So that's part of the problem. Part of it, I think, is also that we are not engaged at the institutional level where our voices can be heard. We know we try to do things like get on citizen review boards and that sort of thing. And obviously more of that needs to happen. But there needs to be a greater civilian presence in the context of the law enforcement institutions, because we've lost sight of the fact that they work for us, supposedly. They are supposed to serve us. And somehow that's gotten terribly skewed the other way. It's not unrelated to the trend of pro-law enforcement that we've seen in this country over the last 30 years. So that they have a lot of carte blanche that maybe they shouldn't have. Maybe they need to be more accountable. So that's some of the problem as well. How to change it is a much more complicated and long-term discussion and strategy that we have to figure out as a community. How do we get our voices heard? How do we make sure they understand that we aren't going to let these kinds of things go unchallenged? And that's a much longer strategy that may have to involve several other levels of engagement that don't necessarily have to do directly with the police department.
So. My question went a little bit further. What are the specific mechanisms the police departments use to block the process, the judicial process, and to ensure the product that has been the case so far on all these kinds of cases?
I don't know if a case that gets to trial can be affected by a police department instruction, with maybe some exception as to what information might be available to you. Ultimately, if a case goes to trial, the prior fact is the jury. So if the information that gets to the jury or doesn't get to the jury is somehow being manipulated by the police department, then that's where you could focus your attention and see whether or not there's a history of corrupt behavior with regard to what gets to a jury. Of course, that's always a possibility. And how you find that will be from getting people who are familiar with law enforcement and lawyers and judges who can trace some of those situations and find out where and how it's being manipulated before it gets to a jury.
I have a question. You say if this case has got a lot more resources than other murder cases. And my question is, because the last time I heard a lot of the witnesses, there was a lot of witnesses who witnessed this, hadn't even been interviewed by the district attorney yet. So my question is this could this be a setup? Because so after the fact, they could say, well, look, you put all these resources in, but then come to find out that they didn't do their job, even though they rushed it and they put all these so-called resources in it, they haven't even interviewed all the witnesses yet.
That's kind of a catch-22, because you want the case to move on, but you can't get everybody interviewed if you delay it. So oftentimes, and it's just the case with all cases, I'm a criminal defense attorney now, I'm
tried a murder case. I'm in the middle of a murder case right now. It is not uncommon for people that are associated with the evidence to not be interviewed until the day of trial or when the trial is going on. I have an investigator that's constantly working on the case with me while I'm in the process of doing it. So it is not uncommon that folks who are potential witnesses aren't even interviewed until you get closer to the trial or while you're in the trial. At some point, there's a decision made by either side that says, I've got 20 witnesses that I think are relevant to this case, and another 20 that might be relevant. I'm going to work with this first 20 and then work my way into the next group. That is a trial technique as far as preparation that sometimes happens. It happens oftentimes. I don't know enough about what witnesses have not been interviewed. I don't know whether or not what they have would even be admissible, because at some point, both the defense and the prosecutor has to make a decision on whether or not they just interview people to interview people, because resources and time are very valuable. But just try to keep somewhat of an open mind, and as you're doing what you're doing today, and as you're learning about the process and educating yourself, you may find out that those witnesses should have been interviewed, and that can give you an opportunity to make your voice heard, or you may find out that they were what we call peripheral witnesses that are sort of just on standby, and they may be material when we get closer to trial and more information is revealed.
Actually, if I can respond to those questions quickly, I think progressives in California have to take the criminal justice system more seriously. We have to talk about restructuring the entire system. There are people in California doing life for petty theft and with a bribe. The only state, our criminal justice system is worse than Texas and worse than Florida. It's more racist, more reactionary. Nobody in Texas, the United States, can do life or pay theft, except in California. It's under the three stripes law. We have to restructure that. And let's be honest, I'll tell you, most judges in California are former prosecutors. This may not be true in California, the Bay Area, because they're appointed by Republican governors. And also, prosecutors have a certain mindset. They're there to get convictions. And most of the people who are charged, arrested, charged, prosecuted, and sent to prison are either young people of color in the Valley, white working class people. I represent poor. There are poor and white working class people in state prison, but not very many white cops, and not very many white corporate criminals. So we have to talk about restructuring the entire system. And that's the fundamental flaw, is that, let's be honest, in California we have a totally racist, arbitrary, discriminatory criminal justice system, from the top to bottom. And it's a disgrace that we live in such a liberal state. We have this horrible free swipes law, and then nobody in the state legislature has the political background to amend it.
One of the things I think is important with respect to this young man's question is that if we know there are witnesses who were there and should have been called to testify, then that's certainly something as a community that we can do. We can catalog and we can record those statements. We can get the names of those people and record their statements, and that is the kind of direct action that we could take that could make a difference if that information is presented to the DA or given to the press or given to the U.S. Attorney to say, this is why we know that the state did not vigorously prosecute this particular officer for his crime. So that's a point of practical engagement that we can do and get that information on record somewhere. I think it's important to know with respect to your question about how is it that the cops get away with this sort of thing. We have to acknowledge that there is corruption of the system. And the reason why corruption can exist is because it's hidden and it's kept from view. And we may not have even known about the Oscar Grant situation, but for the wonders of modern technology, and it just so happened that somebody was there videotaping. That's often how corruption comes to light. Sometimes it's just the luck of the draw. And again, it's because of the vigilance of individuals like us who won't let these things go away, who keep it in the public's eye, who make us each other aware of what's going on. And so those are some practical steps we can take. We don't have to depend on the criminal justice system to work right for us to find these people and get their information on record somewhere. We don't have to depend on them to do the right thing if we're there watching what they do.
Exactly. That's a very good point. I just wanted to just
again to remind people that we see your hands. We want everybody to be able to speak. So please, when you ask your questions, please make it as concise as possible. Try and limit the follow-up questions to take what we have until 2:30. And our panel does need to leave, so no further ado. Thank you.
I think that one of the things that's probably on everyone's mind is that because of all sorts of different social reasons, Natalie's going to get a sentence which is not fair. I know that this is a teaching about the preliminary hearing, and we're primarily talking about that. But when I look at the photo given out at the table, I see a number of demands that are very attractive to me. Calls to disarm the Black police and disband the Black police. And I think it's important to keep in mind that there is a larger movement that has called for things like boycotting the bar and calls for the workers at the bar taking action in order to accomplish some of the goals which we're trying to talk about here. And in response to the gentleman in the yellow shirt who was asking earlier about concrete things that make up this oppressive system, I'd like to bring up one thing, which is the police officers' bill of rights. It's something I've just been reading about recently. It was introduced, I think, in the 70s, and it includes 78, right. And it includes all sorts of protections for police officers, like protections on interrogation, protections against stuff being put into personnel files, it prevents your locker from being searched in the course of an investigation. There are all sorts of protections in there. And I believe that was used as a justification for making the hearings at the Oakland Police Review Board close to the public. So, that's one demand that we've been organized around, revoking that bill.
$3 million bail that $300,000 for the escape. pay, but I learned yesterday at the town hall they don't get part of that, and the rest of it's on their common sense. The other thing is we learned at the Bar Police Board Review hearing that they're still not finished with their internal affairs investigation almost 5 months after this hearing case. So I'm just wondering, those are the things that make me question what other special things are occurring in this case, given the special relationship that has been described between the police and the prosecutor's office. So could you give us other clues or things that we should be looking for that are different than a normal civilian case?
I don't know if any of us here have that type of information. I'm not privy to what's going on with internal affairs. I couldn't tell you why it's taking so long or whether or not that's the normal time it takes. And maybe other people in this room that can speak more intelligently about where the internal affairs investigation is and where it should be. Those other matters that you're discussing or you're questioning, I don't have enough information to speak intelligently about that. I don't know if you're going to be able to.
The problem is, Mesmerly resigned, so he cannot be disciplined. And that happens a lot. I mean, all the time in these cases, if there's serious charges. But my mistake, Bart has hired this kind of law firm that's paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to do a total evaluation of the situation. And that's going to take time. I mean, it raises a lot of complex questions. But there's deeper problems with Bart, and there's deeper problems with civilian review in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco. We don't really have time now to go into the problems, but there's no real independent, powerful civilian police review boards anywhere in the Bay Area. San Francisco has supposedly the strongest model, but it's very, very flawed, and that's the problem. Because again, it goes back politically, the police unions control the government. In the city of Oakland, the city of San Francisco, POAs get whatever they want, including here in Oakland.
And again, what I would emphasize is to the extent you have this kind of information, document, because you may not be able to really impact what happens by raising a stink about the fact that the guy got out on bail less than what he should have paid, but to the extent that kind of information can be exposed to the public, through the media, keep documentation of these things as they happen, because this is precisely the kind of information that would capture the interest of the U.S. attorney in terms of raising questions about whether this prosecution was vigorously handled.
In regards to the resolution of the district attorney in prosecuting this case, the political reality is that any district attorney who is successful in a murder charge against a cop will probably not be in office after the next election. Millions of dollars will be poured in. Now, to the degree to which this success this affects the current Alameda County District Attorney is an open question. We should always keep that in mind. That's why we have to maximize the kind of pressure where no matter what his fear is about his future, maybe he'll do the job, maybe not.
Being well in tune with what's going on with the community and the the political aspects of it. I think that's probably why you got to sign the case, because they know that you need someone with his background and his experience. So I feel, based on my own experiences with him, what I know about him, that they selected the right judge.
I think we have time for one more question. Anyone? Well, I saw somebody who hadn't gotten a chance to ask. Go ahead, though.
Okay. We all seen the video, right? We all seen the video. So this is my question to you. We've seen that Tony Pollard was assaulted and robbed a young man. So what I'd like to know, and then he turned around and he says his life was in danger by Oscar Grant. So Oscar brought this on himself. So we all seen the video, we know he's lying. So can Tony Pollard be brought in as a witness?
Who's Tony Pollard again?
He's the police officer that was the initiated the murder.
He was one of the bar police officers that actually hit him, knocked him down on the ground, and pinned him down on the platform, and that's actually how he was pinned in order to be shot.
Right. Well, I mean, that certainly would be some of the evidence they should bring in, I would think. But again, it's easy to say that without knowing exactly how the police reports were written and all that sort of thing. But it's definitely the kind of evidence that the jury should consider when they are making a determination about this guy's guilt. Now, what his position will be if he's called as a witness, if he's called, he could be called by either side as a witness. And, you know, so much will depend on how the proceedings go and how that evidence is presented or offered, and whether or not it meets evidentiary requirements and that kind of thing. So it's not as easy to say, yes, it definitely will be admitted. They may put limitations on what he can testify to and that sort of thing. So it can be kind of involved. But it should be part of the evidentiary thing.
He could potentially invoke his privilege against self-incrimination and refused to testify. And even if he were granted immunity by the district attorney, he potentially has a federal criminal civil rights violation, which would give him an independent privilege against self-incrimination. So if he could probably avoid, if he wanted to, he could probably avoid testifying too very much about what happened.
I'd just love to ask the panel, I know some of you have to leave right now, but for the other people that will be here just a little longer, I just wanted to extend it for maybe about 5-10 minutes so we can get to maybe two more questions, if that's okay with the panel.
That's fine.
Okay. Do you think the district's office has left unexplored avenues to extend criminal prosecution due to the supervisor and policymakers who live apart or the city government?
I think that's a loaded question. It's a question that can be asked about any prosecution in any particular case. I don't know if you want to be able to go through a line of liability, because then that goes through the civil part. Who was the supervisor? Who recruited him? Who put him into the police department? What policies existed? All those things. Those aren't typically the type of things that you bring into a criminal charge. My experience is that's more on the civil line. So you probably see a lot more of that with what's going on in the civil case.
So real quick, I want to send a super question. I'm unclear about, so he resigned, why didn't OPD then take him in and question, like, why was it separate? That doesn't make any sense to me. Is it because they're separate police organizations, so they're equal and they can't challenge each other? What's the deal with why he wasn't questioned by some law enforcement agency in this area after that?
He was attempted, but he chose not to speak. Once you were arrested, they asked you, would you like to give up your Miranda rights and give a statement? You said no. What was the other part?
Prior to the
Well, you got to arrest someone before you can ask them a question, and what they were doing and what they typically do, they try to get their information ahead of time. And anybody is going to be interrogated, the interrogator has to have as much information as possible. And how long that takes is a point of criticism. I understand and I respect that. But sometimes it takes longer than others. As you can see, the investigation is still going on. If you really want to investigate somebody, you want to know what everybody saw. You want to see every particular video. You want to have the ability to present them with conflicting information depending on what they have to say. And at the time in which he was arrested, that would have been a good opportunity because I believe they had enough information to do a thorough interrogation, but he chose to do what many people choose to do, which is not give a statement.
I'm wondering if the district attorney could be implicated in this Jerry Amaro case, which involves corruption in the OPD, and apparently he decided to shelve this case of a police officer that brutalized Jerry Amaro and ended up dying, and then they put it down to a low-level prosecutor, and it seems like maybe he might even be under the focus of the FBI, and I'm just wondering if you have any, because it seemed like their integrity is really in question there.
I don't know enough about that particular case. I tell you what I thought about how it's being handled. I think you should also keep in mind that I'm just saying this to be objective. A couple years ago, this same district attorney called out a flack in the police officer because he prosecuted or tried to prosecute the rioters. Not once, but twice, at the cost of an awful lot of resources and time. So you should keep in mind that this was a prosecutor, or is a prosecutor and district attorney, who put resources together not once, but twice, to try to prosecute four police officers who were accused of a number of different felony crimes.
We got time for one more question, and I know we're going to have to move on. So, again, thank you very much for actually being here and being able to give your insight. This is very helpful to Jerry Amaro and the world.
Yeah, I heard you earlier mention the trial in L.A. and then, of course, this situation here. But what I didn't hear you say, this feeds into the question I'm trying to craft for you, is that it was after NASA's intervened in that L.A. situation, after that so-called, after they had the so-called verdict, they tried to get it locked them up because they understood the cost was too high to perpetrate that fraud. Now, we didn't have the same situation. I don't know if any of you have paid attention to this, but the people that are currently running this prosecution through a case, that's why Tony was making remarks about the setup. These are crooks, we know them. Low, low human material. There was a case called the Rioters that I found out a little bit about and did a little investigation of my own, working with some cop watch contractors. You know what? I was shocked. I was literally shocked to find out that many of the people that had been assaulted by these police were ordinary citizens in West Oakland. They weren't criminals at all. The papers constantly said that the people who were abused were drug addicts and they sold drugs. And I went house to house talking to these people, meeting them, and it just wasn't true. So one of the things that occurred is the pig, the cheap pig that was involved in all this, just left the state. You have here a so-called prosecution that was so vile and so incompetent that when their chief defendant runs, they still lost the case. How do you lose a case? I later found out they didn't even call as witnesses all of those citizens that I had talked to who had written complaints, so it's not like they didn't know about these people. Okay? So in a real situation like this where we know we're dealing with pigs within the pigs, what are our bona fide options here? What can we really, what can really be accomplished in terms of checking, somebody made a point earlier also about the bail hearing. And there were two motions filed, one for the DA, one for Oscar, supposedly. The DA mentioned that Oscar had been locked up. That's the only thing he had to say about Oscar. And this is, y'all might be aware of this, I don't know. The other document went on to say that Mr. Miserly loved black people and jazz and Jesus Christ. It just went on and on and on. And it's kind of obvious, it was so obvious, I was shocked to see, and this is what we're up against, right? A defense lawyer who's really kind of defending his client, these police, and a DA that feels that Oscar ain't nothing but a criminal. We got work to do, y'all. Look at the room and think. So I would just, what do you do when you know you're in that kind of situation and you're dealing with a corrupt department that has already thrown an obvious case, which was the rioters. In that situation, what practically could we do to monitor and pressure these legal minions?
I will briefly respond and let you know that I respect your opinion as I do everybody else's, but you can't have an intelligent conversation with law enforcement. You can't be recognized with being able to have anything happen if you're wired in to believing that you're talking about pigs. We can't do that. I work in that department. I know the people. I know some of what happened with the Rivers case. So I'm going to respectfully disagree about your opinion about throwing a case. A case went to a jury twice with people of color. The people of color were the ones who said they didn't have enough evidence and that they hung the jury. So we've got to be a little bit more honest about what happens when we get into those type of situations. And with that, I'm going to have to be ready to leave. I cannot just let stuff be said and not have some type of response based on my own personal experience with those cases.
I don't have the details on what happened in the Ryder's case and why they got the result they got. But it brings to mind one thing that I have advocated for a long time, is that there being, whether the Attorney General's office or someplace else, a special prosecution unit, which the job of which is to handle prosecutions of police who are charged with committing crimes. And it comes from recognition of the fact that there's a close relationship between local police and local district attorney's offices, which often makes it difficult for the district attorney's office to have the stamina and the will to prosecute the people that they've got to work with on a regular basis. And for that reason, I've often advocated that the prosecution of police be from a separate unit.
We still, as a matter of fact, looking at the panel, actually leave right now. So we're going to wrap up this section. We appreciate the questions. We are moving into another session right now. We're actually going to have a video slide presentation that will give us a transition from all of the legal talking, but the discussion that we've had. So just again, I want to thank all of the panel members for being able to address those issues. Thank you very much. The next big section that we've got actually will deal with the policies. We'll deal with the political context, the implications, and there'll be even more room for discussion from everyone in here. So, look for that. We'll be right back to that point.
While we're waiting on this, we're going to be recording right now. Just a reminder, tomorrow's the court date. Press conference in the morning, 8 a.m. We're going to be there. You see, you heard from some of the panelists stress the importance of us being present. And that's what we can do. That's what's in our power. So folks, come out tomorrow. This hearing is going to be going on probably all week. So
folks would come out anytime during 8 to 5, 8 to 3. Spend 10 minutes to an hour, come with us down, be downtown with us. I know it's going to make a big difference.